So first of all, I'd like to introduce myself, and then I just want to do a round after that, just to figure out who you guys are. So I'm Eric Sorensen, and I'm down the road from here at McMaster University in Hamilton. And I'm not going to really talk about my research specialty, but as you, just to tell you what I work in, then generally what I do is condensed matter theory. It turns out that a huge number of the problems that I'm interested in are rather intractable from any kind of analytical perspective, so I end up doing a lot of computational stuff to answer some of the questions that we're interested in. But so just to warn you, I don't know anything at all about string theory, so I see that may be an added benefit for you guys. Anyway, so this course here is about the so we now have the problem that I'm not even sure what the course is called. I thought it was called scientific computing until last night. Then I saw that it was actually called scientific computation. So it's not two courses. Don't worry. It's just one course, right? So we're going to get started in a minute, but before that we do that, I'm Eric, right? And so I just want to do a quick round, so maybe we should start here. Just tell me your name and maybe where you're from.
I'm from Vietnam.
Okay. I'm Matt from Alaska.
I'm Catherine, I'm from Australia.
Heather, I'm from BC.
I'm from New York.
I'm Anton from South Africa.
I'm local.
So why don't we let's start up and we'll switch over to you. So where are you? Okay.
I'm from Massachusetts.
Okay. And then we have somebody who's
yes, I'm from Canada.
I'm Andy Kearns from Portugal.
Okay. Lauren from New York.
McMaster.
Peter from India.
Oh, where about you?
Bloomington.
Oh, okay. I did that 2 years ago.
I'm Neva from Quebec and Ohio.
From Quebec and Ohio?
Yeah.
So we can, I'll do the course in French.
I'm Michael.
Okay.
I'm Sofini from Cameroon.
Shane from Australia.
Laurel from California.
I'm Joel from Quebec.
Okay. I'm James from Scotland.
Oh. I'm Trevor from Manitoba.
I'm Eduardo from Brazil.
I'm Laura from Finland.
Oh, okay. Finding this in England. I'm born and raised in Denmark, by the way. May not be obvious.
I'm Antik from Finland.
Oh, two. I'm
Solomon from Nigeria.
I'm Olga from Estonia.
Okay.
And Bruno in Russia.
I'm Sebastian from Poland.
I'm Felix from England.
Okay. I'm going to probably pick up some of your names, but I'm not going to promise that I'm going to be able to memorize all your names unless we really get going. And I should warn you that you may not think that you get a lot of sleep, but I get less sleep than you do because I have small kids. The problem with that is that my short-term memory is fried because I usually sleep maybe 3-4 hours. So if I repeat myself or introduce myself several times, that's the excuse that I use. So there is a few. I have a list of few things that I wanted to say here in the beginning. So that's me. If you want to know more about what I do, then come and see me over coffee at some point. McMaster University is, by the way, also a great place. I can tell you everything there is to know about the department, and you may bump into other people from there. In fact, you've probably seen a few of them. I want to say something about why we're doing this course. And there are two goals that I want to perhaps aim at with this course. And the first is that I want to try to get you to the level where you feel comfortable writing small programs. Or doing sort of small calculations. Why? I assume that the reason why you're here is probably because most of you are way more interested in theory than in, for instance, experiment or computation, for that matter. Am I right in assuming that? Nobody wanna? Yes, okay. So I can tell you, and Dennis can confirm this, that when you start going with the theory and the analytical calculation, then quickly you'll end up with some kind of expression, and you'll realize that the only way you can actually evaluate that is by performing some kind of numerical calculation. Okay, so that means that even, I don't know anybody who does theory who doesn't end up doing some kind of computation. May not be that this will be your life's career, that's fine, but you cannot avoid it, okay? So it's unavoidable that you will end up doing this. And so you should be able to figure out or get yourself started later on in your career when you have some enormous integrals that is not possible to do otherwise, but you feel convinced that if you can evaluate these integrals, maybe you can calculate that mass of that particle and you will have solved the world's energy problems. Well, maybe not, but you could come close to that, right? So the goal isn't that I'm going to convince you all to become computational scientists, but it's something that will be a necessity in your career. The other thing I want to say is that whatever you go, you will be confronted with people like me who are going to show you results that came out of some humongous, breathtaking calculation. And maybe we're going to tell you that, oh, by the way, my calculation shows that whatever you do is nonsense. Now, you have two choices. You can say, oh, yeah, sorry, I'm going to have to retract my papers. Or you can say, oh, I remember that I did a course in scientific computing, and maybe I can actually say that the Monte Carlo method that was used here, I cannot see how that can possibly be efficient, so maybe it's your results that are incorrect. But to enter into that dialogue, what is right and what is wrong, it's critical that you guys have an understanding for how are these calculations performed, and particularly, for instance, in cosmology and astronomy. At least four or five of the researchers in my department are engaged in large-scale simulations showing how planets are formed, for instance. You can draw quite powerful conclusions from these simulations. The question is, suppose that they collide with your theories for the creation of the universe and inflation and I don't know, I'm not an astronomer, so I can just invent buzzwords here. But in order to be able to use these results in a constructive manner so we all progress, then we have to get that dialogue going. So you have to gain some kind of understanding for what is it that these methods can do for you, right? After all, for instance, if you're interested in particle theory, a lot of the highest or best estimates of particle masses, it comes, for instance, from simulations in lattice gate theory. And lattice gate theory actually happens to look exactly like quantum and Monte Carlo simulations and some condensed matter problems. So there's a whole duality going there, but it's based on Monte Carlo methods. So one thing that we want to gain some understanding for is, what is a Monte Carlo method? What can it do for you? When can it, for instance, fail? It's okay. So for me, it's perfectly okay if you take this course and you say, okay, that was not to my liking. I learned it, but I'm not gonna continue in that direction. That's perfectly fine. I can give you another example. When I went to grad school, I for some reason disliked Maxwell equations. I know I shouldn't say this in public. I guess there's probably a law against this. Yeah, so we took, but you know, taking an E&M course, if you go to grad school, it's you have to do that, right? And I did so, and everything went fine, and I'm here today, so I guess we all survived. But it's incredibly useful for me to have that knowledge, even though I'm not using it in an extensive way. So I would like you to look at this course in the same way, that even though you feel that this is not going to be your end career goal, of course, if it is, then come and see me, right? And we can talk. Okay, I shouldn't go. So I think the we have to understand other researchers. Let's put it this way. Today, with the complexity of problems that you'll be looking at, if you just say you don't even want to talk to these people, you're going to be in a corner sitting all alone. So then there's another question that we... I'm always being asked. That's why Fortran. So I have a few answers to that question, but because of course you're sitting saying that, well, I have my own language, or I've heard about this other language, and it's so much better, right? So that's fine. So one reason why I like it is that the learning curve is fairly steep, shallow. In other words, if what I'm going to be doing today, tomorrow, and probably parts of Wednesday, I'm going to tell you a little bit more than Dennis did in the introductory lectures about Fortran, and yeah, it won't be all that exciting, but I'll try to introduce the most critical features of Fortran, and I would claim we can see how things are going, and if it doesn't go, then you should speak up, please. But the hope is that we can in three lectures get to a point where you can write a little program and execute it with some reliability. I would like probably in some distant future to maybe do this in C++, but then we would be spending all 3 weeks just talking about C++, and that I cannot do with any kind of So for an instructional purposes, then this is very useful. The other thing here is that this is a class what I sort of loosely would call a high-level programming language. So other ones would be, for instance, C, C++, et cetera. I want to distinguish this from what I would call interpreted languages. And interpreted languages, that would be, for instance, Python, Perl, Ruby. If you ever want to look at these languages, they're just brilliant. And but if you want to, for instance, look at how gas planets can form around a star, you would not do it in Python. And the reason for this is that when we look at execution speed, then if a program in Fortran would take about 1 week, then in Python, for instance, it would take in there's a roughly a factor of more than 100 in execution speed. So if your program takes 1 millisecond here, you won't notice that it takes 100 milliseconds in Python, right? And so most of the programs that you'll be doing here. Sure, can be compiled, but you don't gain as much as you do as the other ones. Still, I think the estimates here are 100, that's for a compiled version of Python. If you do it, if you're running it and interpret it, then it's probably in excess of 100. So, for instance, of the computers that I use, Python is not allowed because it's considered a waste of resources. So that's a nothing against Python. I think that's great. But it's not feasible to perform sort of real scale calculations using Python. But of course, if you do a little program that runs in 1 millisecond here, if it takes 100 milliseconds here, then you won't notice it. But if I do a simulation that takes 1 week, 100 weeks would be probably very close to 2 years. And I don't know if you would wait that long. And it becomes a problem if you're trying to do your master's or you're doing your PhD and you really like Python and you insist on doing it in Python and you won't graduate. Take this up to quite a bit of the calculations that I do, maybe a month here. 100 months, that's a long time, right? Currently also, C++, the best estimates that I can see is that there's a factor of 10 here. There are reasons for that. So finally, I would like you to introduce to you to a program that is at high level. What I mean by that is a little bit vague, but mainly I mean that when it's interpreted to something or compiled into something that will run on your computers, it's very efficient. When we look at these high-level programming languages, then C, does anybody?
Yes. Do you know any estimate for the speed in the program written in C?
In C, I think it's probably intermediate between what I call here Fortran and C++. You know, these are just numbers from my personal experience, so we can start a whole war about this, and I just don't think we should go there, right? The thing about it is that programming languages are also evolving and compiler technology is evolving. So whatever we decide on today, maybe next year things will have changed, and that's how it should be. So does anybody know who invented C, for instance? Nobody knows who invented C.
Why is it called C?
Because there were other programming languages that were called B and A first. That's the answer to that. But it was invented at Bell Labs by, I think, Kernighan and Ritchie. And the reason why they invented it was because they had this PDP 11 computer that was made by Beck, I think, sitting around in the corner, and they didn't like the operating system. So they wanted to create a new operating system, and the operating system that they created was Unix. And they realized that in order to create the operating system, it was very convenient to develop a new programming language, and that programming language became Unix. So there's this very, very intimate relation between C and Unix, because C was basically invented for developing an operating system. And today, I guess now I've been brainwashed, but if I were to develop another operating system, I would probably do it in C, just because it's very good for that. Fortran, on the other hand, and then, of course, so I'll tell you a little bit tall tale here. When I did my master's in Denmark, there was this guy in the department who was finishing his master's, and one of his jobs was to develop a pre-processing object-oriented add-on to C. And then he eventually moved to Cambridge and did his PhD there. And that evolved. So this was Bjarne Stroustrup, the inventor of C++. He also then, after Cambridge, ended up in Bell Labs and is now actually at Texas A&M. But C++ here, came about because people got interested in object-oriented methods. I love object-oriented methods. We're not going to talk about it here. That's fine. But it was developed by computer scientists. So I won't say anything bad about computer scientists here. But what they look at is sort of niceties in the language that are very aesthetically attractive and that you can, from a theoretical perspective, argue are just really great. So aesthetically, if you look at C++, it'll just blow you away. And certainly if you look at it and compare it aesthetically to Fortran won't look that pleasing. But the downside to that, so what people do in the Fortran community is that say, well, we don't care about computer science. What we want is efficiency. So today, Fortran has actually adopted quite a bit of the features that you see from C and C++. So Fortran has gone from you may in future courses hear about Fortran 77. They're actually preceding standards to this. The 77 that goes from the year it was the standard was adopted. After that, you go to Fortran 90. Then there was a minor addition to it in 95. After that, there was a new standard. We introduced a lot of features in 2003. And then the latest one is Fortran 2008 that actually introduces something that's called co-arrays here, which I'm not going to tell you about. But I adapted because the people have realized that computing on parallel systems is critical today, so it's been sort of built into the standard. So Fortran is very much evolving, and so is C and C++, for instance, as well. But the goal here is always efficiency. So you're more than welcome to say that you prefer programming in C or C++. But what you'll see here is that if you look at any kind of scientific library that you pull out, then almost all of them will be written in Fortran because of this, that all the features here are adopted or modified based on how efficiently can we make the compiler. This was one of the reasons why Fortran for a long, long time didn't have pointers. It was not that they couldn't do it, but simply it made the programs inefficient. So the emphasis in Fortran here is on efficiency, and it's sort of the programming language that you use for scientific computing, and the The name itself, Fortran, is just a shortened version of formula translation. So it was invented in 1958 or 57, I can't really remember anymore, for the specific purpose simply of taking mathematical formulas and then executing them efficiently on computers. So if whatever you do in some kind of computing, suppose you're here, you want to evaluate your gigantic integrals, you realize that they're very efficient routines in some library, but you realize that that library is actually based on Fortran code from 1960. So it's useful to be able to understand that code and what it might do for you. Okay, I'm going off the deep end here, so I just want to say a few more things. There's a book here, and Dennis told me that this is going to be available somewhere. We have a number of copies. What you should do is read it from end to end and memorize it. That was a joke. I don't know if anybody ever read. Yes.
The students are going to have it one book per room.
It's not the brand latest standard of Fortran. As I said, we're up to Fortran 2008. But there's a very significant lag between what features are implemented in your compiler and what's in the Fortran standard. And that goes for all programming languages that, well, we're humans and the development cycle is strange. What you should do here is that whenever there's something that you're stuck with, then you should look in the index here and then read a little bit about it and maybe read half a chapter and say, oh, well, you know, that's kind of neat. And so please do make use of this. As I mentioned, I'm going to be talking a little bit about Fortran and some other general features of programming for probably the first 3 days. And then I'm off to other things that will be largely independent of what's a Fortran. And it'll be a lot of the stuff will be covered in this book by Pang, that's called Computational Physics. And last year we had at least a couple of one copy maybe that was here. Ross looks like he see, that's, you know, the students that come to the lectures, they weigh. There's some intersection with what I'll be telling you, so you can maybe leaf through that. It's not strictly necessary to have access to that to this book, but you may enjoy reading it. So to finish with this long discussion, I think we're going to run the tutorials in Fortran, just because, you know, you should take the opportunity to learn that language. If you have never programmed before, the advantage is that I think you can get to the point where you can do something relatively quickly. And if you by Wednesday, or let's say Thursday, because there won't be a tutorial on Wednesday, if you by Thursday really think that writing a little 10-line program and compiling it is mysterious to you, then you should definitely scream out, because there will be homeworks where you will be required to do some programming, okay? So we need to get that to that point by Thursday. If some of you are already expert C or C++ or Java programmers, then all the power to you, that's fine. I would still insist that for the tutorials here and for the lectures, please take the benefit of learning a new language, because it's going to come in handy later on.
So about the homework assignments, we're going to hand out the first one tomorrow, isn't that right? Dennis is not. Yeah, so the homework, first homework will be handed out tomorrow, and then it's, and then it'll be due the 9th. So Mathematica, Maple, MATLAB, what was the Python is not acceptable. So don't come and tell me that the homework assignment, I can do it in Mathematica. It's not MATLAB, it's Maple. Sorry. Because I'll be honest, probably a few of them you can do in Mathematica in one line. The goal is that we wanna learn. Actually, so what I would encourage you to do is, whenever you do any kind of computation or numerical, it's crucial that you can verify that whatever it is you do is correct. So for instance, probably at some point we'll be doing an integral, and you have Mathematica on the laptops, is that right? Wow, you got it made. I can't spell today. It should be Mathematica. Whenever you can, then just verify the results that are coming out. And in some cases, we'll be looking at precision and how many digits we can get, and I'm assuming that Mathematica could do a good job in doing that. But that's just if you have the time. Don't use these. So these, by the way, are, well, at least Mathematica and Maple are what we would call symbolic computational packages. So they can do something that I'm not going to tell you anything about, which is symbolic manipulations. And you can program Mathematica to a large extent and do wonderful things in it. But we're not going to talk about that today. Yes?
These programs, Mathematica, Maple, MATLAB, aren't they scientific computation experts?
Sure.
So why we don't use them?
Why you don't use them?
Why we don't use them?
First of all, Mathematica here was. Does anybody know who made Mathematica?
Wolfram.
Yeah, Wolfram, your good friend Wolfram. That's some. Until you get to the point where you have to pay. And it's not a good friend of Mathematica was invented for symbolic manipulation. And that's really the power. That was the goal. There are a couple of other ones, and so Maple here, for instance, fall into that class. The problems here that I'm talking about, you could never. Think about doing it in Mathematica. Mathematica today has been extended, so it does a lot of numerical work for you, but nowhere near, probably I would assume that Python would be running faster than Mathematica. But I never checked that in any great extent. I think Mathematica is great, The kind of problems that we want to be looking at here, you're not going to be able to do them in Mathematica. Yes?
Talk about using the most efficient algorithms for everything in their programs, for example, MATLAB or even Mathematica. But if we can write a program in Fortran after 3 weeks that is faster than their most efficient algorithms, so.
Yes?
Is it true?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we haven't quite decided on the homework problems, but one of the homework problems that you like to do will involve running what's called the Lanczos method. And so by the way, for those who don't know, MATLAB is a front end to standard mathematical library that's written in Fortran, by the way. So it allows you to access that library without really knowing what you're doing, and that's great. But so I had a student that just liked MATLAB so much that he decided to do the MATLAB version of that homework assignment. And after 2 weeks, he had to concede because he was not going to be able to hand it in on time. So you can try it in MATLAB. Do it in Fortran, and you'll see that the program that you do in Fortran is not going to be very long, maybe 30, 40 lines or so. And you can probably do it the same amount of lines in MATLAB, but the execution time is you're not. So it's been tried. People, of course, then you can always find some loophole where it might be comparable in speed, but. The penalty you get for that is enormous.
Integral Mathematica could be better than Fortran.
Shut up! you're talking numerically. I hope we're going to go through some of these. So the great force of Mathematica is, for instance, that it may be able to tell you an analytical expression for an integral. And that's great. Unless, of course, you actually give it an integral that you're interested in knowing the result from that comes out of your research, and then you'll realize that the class of problems that you can actually numerically or analytically integrate is tiny. So then Mathematica would have to do it numerically, and likely it'll actually be using some of the methods that we'll be talking about. And so I would say that you could do it faster if you have your own program, it would do it a lot faster. But you have the added benefit that you might actually know what it's doing, and so you could understand what's going on. So the... Are there any questions right now? I sort of want to get started before we waste the entire lecture and other things here. If there are no... By the way, if you should all corner me over coffee or lunch, and then we can have heated discussions about... Of course, nobody cares whether Mathematica is better than C or Fortran. The real question is whether you should be using VI or Emacs. So nobody is laughing, so you haven't gotten to that point yet. So VI is an editor, and Emacs is another editor. And for some reason, that can create really heated debates. Okay, so I want to introduce some glossary here that I'm going to be referring to. And so I'll be... I'll be talking about what I call compile time. It's not the actual time it takes to compile something. It refers to what happens when you compile your program. So I'm told here that the Fortran compiler on your computers is IF95, which I'm sort of 95% sure is just an alias. Does anybody know what under Unix is an alias? Well, an alias is an alias. It's just another name here for what's called GFortran. Ross, would you happen to know if that's right? Or? Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think it's
it's just a synonym for G4Fortran, which is an well, it's an open source consortium that has decided on developing an efficient Fortran for the Linux operating system. But so what I mean here by compile time, and in particularly compile time errors, it's errors that can be found during compilation. Are you all cool with me saying compilation? That does that, you understand what I mean when I say that? So compilation is what happens when you invoke the compiler, and it compilation means putting things together, and what that's literally what it does. But there's another step here where, for instance, it would check the syntax. Then, so we will be compiling our program and talk about compile time. The other thing is that I'll be talking about runtime errors. And these, so the program here will fail during execution. And maybe because you divide it by zero or do something else, then there's another thing here. You may say that's probably the worst kind of problem that you can have, in the sense that your program it compiles and it executes without failing, but unfortunately when you look at the results for your integral, then they're all wrong. And you know that because you just did it in Mathematica, yeah?
I'm curious, how do you, if you have a program that takes a bunch of errors, how do you make sure, like how can you ever be sure enough that you don't have something wrong with your program to actually address that?
That's a very, very good question. The way you do it is that you first start out by making a program where you can check it by maybe two or three different methods or other programs. So you do a kind of calculation on a small system. Then you take it up to a larger system where you can cross-check with what other researchers have done. You can see that a problem in doing this becomes verifying the literature. Suppose somebody publishes something in Science and nobody else can check it. Then what are you going to do about it? So you make sure that there are all the limits that you can possibly check analytically, you have to do that. Then you start with a small enough system that you can do it with other programs and other methods. And then you, after that, hook it on to what other published results that you can find. And then you go to the step that you want to get to. But of course, sometimes things will fail and then you, so for instance, some of the calculations I do are in quantum spin systems, and then you verify it with all kinds of symmetries, whatever you can think about. But in the end, of course, if you're doing something new, you're going to have to rely on all these checking and whether it's actually working. Anyway, so I'll be talking about these compile time, runtime, and well, what we might just generally call bugs here, because it gives us wrong results here. So this means that in order to avoid all this here, it becomes very advantageous to develop small subroutines
that can be independently verified. So you want to chop your problem into little sub-problems where you can verify the sub-components independently. Eventually, this, if we were to do computer science, then people got into the game of developing objects and so forth, and there's a lot of theory. But for us, I just want to encourage you to develop small subroutines, small functions that you can verify that they're working, because then when you build up the entire program, then you don't have to check every single line. You know where things have gone wrong here. So try to look here at small components, and that's sort of the overall goal in this. So if I continue a little bit here with the glossary, we want to develop some of these routines here, maybe a library or something like this. What in Fortran this goes under the name of modules, and I'll tell you what that is in a little while here. But when we're executing the program, I'm gonna once in a while tell you about something that I call the runtime system. And this is not a course in computer science or whatnot, this is when you actually launch your program, it will be taken over by the Fortran runtime system. So the runtime system here will, for instance, handle I/O, and I/O, that would be file access. So it will be what for you effectively is the interface to the operating system. Because if you think about it, then you may think that all you're doing in your calculation is just adding up numbers or something like this, but eventually you want to do something with those numbers. So it'll handle I/O. It'll also handle memory allocation. And what it does is that it'll create what is sometimes called the runtime stack. And the runtime heap. I'm not really going to tell you what this here will do, but in general, huge. If you're declaring some humongously big matrix or array, then the runtime system will likely prefer to put it in a special designated area of the memory, which is called the heap, sort of loosely speaking. If you're just accessing a single integer or something like this, then maybe it'll be putting it here on something that's called the stack. And it's called the stack here because it allocates memory on the stack for each procedure. Function call. They get a little space here on the stack, and you can sort of access it up and down here. That doesn't happen over here on the heap. I'll be talking about the sometimes on the when I mentioned the runtime system, in particularly when we do memory allocation what happens. Then it's handled by something like that. And the reason why I want to I want you to know that this exists is because you may develop your program and then move it to a supercomputer center And then you'll realize that there are subtle changes in the memory allocation, I/O, et cetera, that you didn't really think about. And that's not specified in the Fortran standard or anywhere else. It doesn't matter if you're doing C or C++ either. But a lot of that will be controlled by something that you call the runtime system. And that would be, for instance, decided also what the operating system is that you're running under. So these are some of the words that I'll be using. So just to... I looked at the programs that you went through with Dennis, and so let's just have a look again at the sort of simplest program that you can do, and then we'll continue from there. So you would start here, let's call it, some reason in my node, I call it the program circle here. And then we declare two reals here. So we always have what's called a declaration part. That's sort of quite common for a lot of programming languages, except for C++, where you can sort of intermix declarations and executional statements. So we have two real variables, x and y here, and then maybe we here said y equal to the square root of x or something like this. And then I think you looked at I/O here, so I can just write star here. Star in this setting means standard output, and star means non-specified formatting. So I can just write out y here, and then I end the program. Okay. So why is that not good to do this? Anybody see a program problem with this? Did I miss something here and elsewhere? Yes, yes, that's right, that's right. I hate writing programs out on the blackboard because, there's going to be two semicolons here, but I'll tell you, usually at some point you will have a whole list of packages here, that's right. But I just wanted to point you out that here you should always put in an implicit not. And I think it is told you about this, right?
Yeah, I mentioned.
See, we have a confirmation. What this implicit none here means is that no variables are implicitly defined. So this was a mistake that was, in the early 50s and 60s when Fortran was developed, then resources were scarce. So people thought that, well, if we could make a shortcut, then why not? Today, I don't think anybody would conceive of allowing this. So what it would mean here is that I could leave out this part, because standard Fortran would say that x and y, per definition, would be reals, and I, j, k, l, m, n would be integers. So that's what implicitly defined means. But that's very, very dangerous, because at some point in your head, you're going to get it mixed up, and you're going to declare a real, which is called n, or something like this, and not realize that you're doing something horribly wrong. This here means that all variables have to be declared. At this point, you can't do anything about it, because for the Fortran or any compiler, it has to be backward compatible. So you're supposed to be compiling programs that were written in 1958, right? And you can still do that. Some programming languages, they're just going to say, no, we give up, and define a whole new standard that is not backward compatible. That would not be possible in Fortran because you have these huge libraries that are a sort of accumulated knowledge of how you perform these numerical stable routines, and just translating them would be introducing so many errors that people don't do that. And so you have to be able to compile code that was written in late 50s, early 60s. So there's this one. The other thing here is, of course, that maybe we should actually read in a variable for x. Otherwise, I'm probably not going to do anything. So this is this here is what we call executable statements. And so we can define a number of other variables here, and Dennis went through them. But generally, you have a declaration part and an executable part, and you cannot sort of mix them together, even though you would perhaps like to. One sort of great advantage is by almost from birth here, I can go in and just define complex and define a complex number. So when I started in grad school, I was programming a lot in C. And at the time, C didn't do complex number at all. Because when you're writing an operating system like Unix, why would you use complex numbers? So try to think why, how a complex number would occur in designing an operating system. I can't think of any. So they just left it out when they designed C. But of course, any kind of scientific computation invariable ends up involving complex numbers. And still today, the complex number handling that is done in Fortran is unbeatable. I don't know any other programming language that could do that. So I think you went through some of the other data types that you can have, I just wanna say that you can also define what's called a derived data type. So if you have done C, then it's a struct in C. So I can write something here that would be type measurement. And it would have a real here, which would be maybe the pressure. And then it would have an integer here, which would be the measurement number. And so this would be the, so then we have to end with end type measurement here. Now, I go over here and look at my declaration part here. And once I've done something like this, then I can actually go in here. And then when we said real and complex here, then I can actually just go in and say type measurement, and then colon M1, for instance, and then M2. So then you could say, so now I have some kind of variable here, which is not a single real or complex number. It's actually something that has two values, the pressure and then an integer here, which is a measurement number. So how can we assign values to that? Well, I could do something like M1 here. And then for lack of better, we put in a percentage sign. And so I can set if I want to set the measurement number in my variable m1 equal to 1, I do m1 percentage sign measurement number, and then m2 here, or m1 pressure, I set that maybe equal to 2.5 or something like this. So we can assign variables, and once you get this going, then you can see that I can sort of pack things together here and do wonderful things with it. So there's one big difference between C and Fortran, and that I always should mention here, and that's the fact that there's no difference between upper lowercase. And today you probably, people would have, if they were to design Fortran today, they would have made upper and lowercase different. But at the time when Fortran was defined, that was not the case. Now, if you, yes?
When we define a type, the definition has to be made before a declaration?
Yes.
So within the program or
outside? In this case, it would have to be within the program. But I'm going to, I'm not really insisting on this, because what you're going to see in 2 minutes is that you would be defining a module, and then you would be declaring your new types in the module, and then, as you were pointing out here, then you should be just saying use module name here, and you would be in business. So if you have, if you're interested in, so basically all kinds of object-oriented features you can do in Fortran today, and you can define a class. So sometimes I show in class here a definition of rational numbers. So you can see here a pressure and a measurement number is maybe not too interesting, but imagine that we define something that would have a numerator and a denominator. Then I could actually try and attempt to work with rational numbers. Then I would need ways of defining how I multiply them together, and how I divide them, and how I add them up. And this could all be handled if I had a new type here, and then added on with some ways of manipulating that new type. And all that you would be rolling into a module, and then you would here just include a use statement, so you would say use that module. So for the interested ones, I can show you how this is done, but we're not going to try to get there. I'll be telling you about modules in a few seconds. When we before that, then, but just remember here that, well, you have the standard types, which would be real, complex, logical, a character, and sort of a string of characters. But beyond that, then you design your own new variables as you please. I was told that a number of you never did any kind of programming before. Is that right? Or yes. So last year we had a number of students who were just really good at programming, and one of them is Ross here, who's Ross. And he'll, by the way, be here for the tutorial, so he should be able to. But so for the students who have never programmed before, hang on and don't let the
everybody else get ahead of you, in particularly for the tutorials here. Because this is going to pay off at some point. So I mentioned that we want to design programs which is in independent bits and parts, right? That we can check independently so we know it's working here. And we have functions, and then we have subroutines, and then the last class is what we'd call modules. So there are sort of three ways of doing this. And whenever you whenever you're developing your program, it becomes very advantageous to stuff this into independent files. Once you start programming, then if your program has 2,000 lines and it's just in one big file, finding a way around is going to be very difficult. So you want to put your main program in one file, one subroutine in another file, and the golden rule is that if whatever is in a file takes more than a screen, then you should probably be trying to do, well, maybe two screens, but sort of a less than 100 lines, you would not really like to put that into a file. It means you should probably be looking at splitting up what you're doing. So just to run through them quickly here, I wanted to tell you a little bit about functions. Functions and subroutines in Fortran, they start to look very, very much alike. So let's have a look at how we could write one. The first thing here is that you would put in the keyword function, and then you would write fun here. So my functions are called fun because they're supposed to be fun to use. And then we have to give the function an argument. And then we have various different options for what to do next, but I'm going to show you one way of writing a function, and I would encourage you to follow that one. What this means is that after writing the function here, we proceed by writing result and then parentheses value. And so that means that whatever the function is calculating, it should go be put into the variable value here. You with me so far? This may be looking a little bit odd if you're coming from other languages. Let me just interject here that in old style Fortran, whatever the function would be returning would be defined on. So you would say you would have an integer function, and then that would mean that the result would have to be an integer. But I preferred writing it this way because it's a lot more transparent. Yes. Yes. It's a keyword here. Literally type result, and then you say value. May sound a little bit.
Don't you never say you need the type that you
return? I'm about to do that. So that's the. So then we do real here, and we're going to assume that real here is x, and then I'm going to do another real here, and I'm going to say that this is valid. So this here, if you don't want to call that value, you can call it y, if you please. I just have adopted the convention of whatever I put here, I call it value. But as somebody, if you just
pointing out there, then I have to tell it what the function is supposed to be returning. So here I have a function that takes a real as an argument, and then it returns another real. So this is perhaps not so useful when we're looking at functions, but
a subroutine would look almost identical. So what you maybe haven't seen is that when you're declaring a variable, we can give it what's called an attribute. And it's the attribute here that we would put in is intent in. And this is actually one new feature in Fortran. Well, I guess it came in Fortran 90, so it probably has been around for, 20 years? But what this means is that suppose I call the function here, then I'm telling the compiler now that my intention is that x here should be an input variable, because of course we could imagine that the function had several arguments, and particularly with the subroutine, they would maybe have 10 arguments, right? So the intention here is that this is an input, and when I, so this here is called an attribute, and what this means is that when the program, when this function is called, x has to be defined, or it has to be given a value. The other thing here, and that's actually redundant once I put the variable value here, is that I have another one that's called intent out. So here it's redundant. It's probably going to give you an error here. If you do something like this where you're saying that the return value should be intent out, because what you're instructing the compiler to do here is that when you're compiling the program, it should go look in your code here, and if it so happens that you never assign anything to the variable value, it should flag it, right? Because how would you know, right? Suppose you're the compiler and somebody declares a variable, but he never assigns a value to it. Should that be an error? Shouldn't it be an error? Here, you're saying that this, at compile time, should be flagged as an error. So it's a great way of making sure that your intention of writing that function works out. But here, it's going to tell you why you declaring it is intent out when it is a return variable, right? So and then we would likely do something, and then we always have to write with end function fun here. So we'll go through. There are actually quite a few other attributes where you can tell it that a variable, yes?
You have to give a return value. Like, do you have to have your function return something at all? Or can you just have something like say something that writes something on the screen?
Well, in that case, you probably do a subroutine. If you just do a function, so the goal of a function is per se always to have a result value. Fortran would almost certainly, if you just leave all this out, then you would have to then declare the type of the function, and then you could likely do it. But it would not be good practice, right? If you want something that just writes on the screen and doesn't do anything, use a subroutine. Dennis, can I? What am I supposed to be stopping soon?
Well, you still have some time.
Okay. I just wanted to. There's, by the way, when we talk about this intent in and out, so you can see the idea here is that tell the compiler that at this point expect a variable that has been assigned a value, and intent out, tell the compiler that it has to verify that that variable has been assigned a variable. The other thing here is that you can, there's also an attribute here which is intent in out. And
By this we mean that we're looking at a variable which has to be defined and given a value when the function is called, but also be updated during the execution of the function, so the value is new when it's being returned. So you could, for instance, imagine returning the calculated value in X here. Okay, so that would be sort of a basic way of writing a function, and I would encourage you to, whenever you can, put in these attributes here. I should perhaps also say that if you leave out this declaration of these attributes, everything will be fine. It'll compile and nothing will be happening, but the compiler here will not be able to flag any errors. So a lot of these things that you put in with commas and fancy stuff, it's really just instructions to the compiler to try to figure out what was your intention. Okay? It's not like this here is really generating any code. So it's perhaps important to distinguish between when is actual code generated and when is it not. So okay, yeah. So I'm going to take my function here, and I haven't told it to do anything yet, but it doesn't really matter. But it's now in a separate file, and then we have to figure out how to use it. And we would have a program test here, and then I would declare a real here, another real here, which we may be calling y. And then I would set y equal to fun of 1.0. So that means that the dummy argument x here at runtime, it will be given the value it would be giving the value 1, so it's well defined. But for instance, you can see here that if I had defined x as intent in out, then we would have a problem, right? Because this here is a constant, and how could I ever give an constant an output value? So if that was your intention in writing the function, then making use of these intent in and intent in out and so forth is actually quite useful. So we would do something like this, and then we would end the program. So we, yeah. So this is maybe, if you're familiar with other programming languages, then they may be more sophisticated in figuring out what is going on in other parts of the program. Fortran basically takes the point of view that I don't want to know anything at all about what's happening elsewhere. And historically, that was the easiest way to do things. So when we run this program here, the simplest possible thing you can do is just say that my function fun here, will be returning a real, and when I put in the attribute here external, it just means that it's defined elsewhere. You can probably already see where this is going, because at this point in the main program, it won't know anything about what's in the function here, and more importantly, if there are parameters to that function. Maybe it could be fun here of x and a or something like this. Are there several arguments? In other words, here, when we encounter the call to the function, it won't be able to verify whether you're calling it correctly. And that's that's a major problem, and particularly if you're calling some kind of humongous library where the, believe me, I've been there, where the number of arguments to a function is in excess of 20. Then it becomes a problem just figuring out if you have called it with 20 arguments and if you got them in the right order. Here it'll just, it won't check anything. So that's sort of the old-fashioned way of doing it. So of course, today, so for instance, I could call it here, I could have an integer here that would be I, and then I could call the function with an integer I and it would compile fine, and then your guess is as good as mine as to what the results would be. Yes?
To somehow load the file, like, does it just go and, like, search an entire path for something and
when
the file is called?
Okay, so that is, so there's, in my glossary here, there's one thing missing, and that's link time. When you compile a program, suppose you compile this function here, you would usually do it with the minus C option, and then it'll be spitting in a out a file, which would be your file name, with, and then with a dot O. You have to stitch these various dot O files together, and that's done by something that's called the linker. There's also something that's called the loader, but no, let's not talk about that. So the linker would be stitching things together. It does it in first come, first serve. So that means that you could actually have 10 declarations of the function fun here that would be in 10 different .o files, but the one that would be used here in the main program would be the one that would be appearing the first in your, so when you do Fortran 95 and then your main .if90, and then you would have the fun1.o, fun2.o, then it would be that one, the first one that's, and so you could say, oh, what is going on here? Why can't they do something more clever? And that's, of course, because this is a feature, because suppose you have three libraries that all do Fourier transform, and they all happen to have the same name for the Fourier transform function, but you happen, depending on the day that you're working, to prefer one Fourier transform over the other one, then all you have to do is that at the link step you move it ahead, and then suddenly you're using another function. Yeah.
This external thing to be looked at, or where you want to look for the external declaration?
Here, you know, all you're just saying is that this here is just telling it. It's defined elsewhere.
So you can't specify where?
Nothing is specified. So technically what it means is that there will be an entry in what's called the simple table that is just marked satisfied later. So when what the compiler does here is it reads through the program and then it sees, oh, Y here is a real, I know what that is. I here is an integer, I know what that is. Then it reaches fun and it says, oh, I don't know what that is, and so it just puts it in a simple table and say to be satisfied later. And then these .o files, then they have a corresponding simple table which will say, oh, by the way, here is a simple that's defined here. But that simple can occur in many different places here. From the main program here, you don't have any choice. But I'm going to, yeah.
So can you do that? Can you say fun from an integer when your input there was real?
No. Try doing the tutorial. And the answer is yes.
And the answer is, suppose your the fund here was defined under some humongous library package that you paid $1,000 for, the time it will take you before you realize that you had, it could even be that you're, you want to call it with a value here which is y equal to 1, so you want to call it with an integer, but it just so happens that the function was written with a real argument, you know, it could be a long time. So obviously this means that people have wanted to be, have wanted to improve on that, and so I just want to, I just want to say here that this is the old-fashioned way, and then I'm going to tell you the how today you would improve on this, and then the, well, then I'll tell you what to do next. So what we would do today is we would say here that we have a real here, which is a y, but then we would define something that's called an interface. And so the interface is just taking precisely these statements and putting them here. So I would be repeating this here. I would say function fun of x here, the result in V here, and then we would say real intent in, and that would be x here. What else did I have here? Then I would say real, and if I write it correctly, then it should be V here, and then we do end function. So I leave out the executable statement of the function. So I just said end function fun, and then in interface. So again, these are just instructions to the compiler. They're not generating any code at all. It's just for you, because you can see now, when I do integer colon colon I, and I do y equal to fun of I, and then I end my program, now I get an error, right? Because I told it, so this here took the place of where before I had real external fun. Now I just copy the declaration part of the function and sandwich it with an interface in interface. Now the compiler has the complete knowledge, and it'll flag errors like this. Okay, so there isn't anything, the first time you see these interface declarations, you would say, well, what's going on here? But just think about it as a way of telling the compiler here that this is, by the way, the function that I'm talking about here, it should be returning a real, and it should always be called with a real, right? And once you have that, then you have limited out probably 90% of the errors that could occur. So this is, if you have just one function and it's very small, this is how you would do it, but we're going to be talking about modules probably tomorrow. And all this stuff, if you're building a library of functions, you would, in putting it into a module, you would automatically get this as a benefit. So this, an interface declaration, by the way, can do other wonderful things for you. If in this setting, we would probably just stick the function here into a module, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. But you can clearly see here, with this knowledge, the compiler will know what's going on, and we're in business, we can eliminate more errors, right? You had a question.
When you say what's the expression for the function?
That would be declared over here. So if the function here is the some handle function or whatever it is, then it goes into the body here, and all
the information you put here is just basically for the arguments. What's it called with, and what is it supposed to be returning?
In this setting, we would have two files, one with the main program like this, and another file here that I guess we would call fun.h90, and this here would be test.h90. Okay, and whatever the function will do is specified here, not there. Okay.
What is the, when, so you declared your x and your value on the left there, and then you wrote intent in out?
That's just because I was telling you that there's an attribute which is intent in, there's another attribute which is intent out, but there's actually a couple of other options, and you can read about them in the
okay, corporate. So that's not part of your...
No, it's not part of it, it's an interjected comment here that you could define a variable with intention in out, which would mean that it should both be defined on entry and on exit. There are actually going to be a slew of other attributes that we're going to be talking about. So is this clear, right? Two files, that's the interface. And it looks like something profound is going on, but it's just to tell it that it should be checking, yes.
What do you if you wanted to make a function that updated the variable?
That updated the variable,
like
yeah,
the
so...
Field, like the
yeah,
variable.
So we'll be talking quite a bit about this because it's a tricky point, I'll tell you about that, if not tomorrow, then Wednesday. The thing about it is that Fortran will always allow you, per default, to change the variable. So if you know I've been programming before, the default in Fortran is that you do call by reference. It's not a copy of the variable, it's the actual variable that's being passed. So for instance, all you would have to do is just, I would have to set x equal to 2. Then when it's being returned, it has that new value. Mm. Okay, I think we should probably stop here. Yeah.
We should continue. Let's
do another 2 minutes. let's just stop here. Okay, if you have questions right now, or I'll hang around for the tutorial. So, but let's stop here.
So.